Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero. Police in Hallandale Beach are trying to access important information from a potential, quote, witness to a crime. Back in July, a man got into a fight with his girlfriend in the bedroom of their condo. The woman was fatally stabbed during the incident, and now the boyfriend is on trial for murder. Law enforcement believe an Amazon Echo Dot sitting in the couple's bedroom may have recordings that could be useful for the investigation. The story brings into question when law enforcement is able to access our conversations. How private is the information collected by these devices? Michael Frumkin is a University of Miami law professor. He's the founder of the We Robot Conference, an annual conference focused on policy and law in the field of technology. He joins us now via Skype. Mr. Frumkin, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So you've been studying for decades now how the law responds to the newest technologies. Take us back to the earliest days of the internet. Can you tell us a little bit about how the U.S. government was regulating and monitoring that new technology when it first came out?
Well, it was really playing catch up, right? I mean, the internet famously is invented by a bunch of graduate students who admittedly are working in part on government grants. But they're mostly setting down standards in rooms where, you know, they're just on their own and sort of afraid that if a grown-up comes in, they'll tell them they're doing everything wrong. So they write up a whole bunch of critical standards which still define how the internet works today in important ways, and call them requests for comments, even though they're actually decisions, because that way they can't be accused of deciding anything. And then maybe 5-10 years later, the government wakes up and says, my goodness, this thing's important. And starts trying to legislate. And an awful lot of legislation initially is incompetent. Some of it struck down by the Supreme Court. But, you know, with practice, the government starts getting it right. Now we have a lot of relevant legislation. For example, almost every state in the country has a pretty good law on what happens if a company has your data and there's a breach, right? A hacker gets in and gets your personal information and creates various either liabilities or at least requirements that they give you notice that it happened.
And where does Florida fall on that spectrum? Does Florida have one such law?
It does, yes.
So going back to the early days of the internet and when this kind of technology was really coming out, was there an understanding on behalf of the government that the repercussions of monitoring this were severe, that they needed to do this, or was it kind of reactionary?
Well, it depends what you mean by monitoring. So one of the very early fights that I was heavily involved in actually was over cryptography. Right, the government got afraid that people would encrypt their emails, and then they wouldn't be able to wiretap you easily. And we're seeing this again. It's come back today under the name of going dark. That's the name the FBI gives what they claim is the problem. And they were afraid people would encrypt their phone calls. So they came up with a scheme called the Clipper chip. This is in the mid-90s, where they said, we'll give you some really strong NSA-certified crypto, so you don't have to worry about bugs in the algorithm. But the price is, we'll have a back door, and we can always listen in if we get a warrant. And the internet went nuts and said, we don't want that. And of course, since it was American, people in other countries especially didn't want that. And it never took off. So that fight's still going on. They said, you know, what's happened is people are building encryption into products like the iPhone. Mm-hmm. And the government's really not happy about it, although they're finding technical workarounds. There's debate about how effective and expensive they are. But you know, the sky hasn't fallen yet.
So the debate is ongoing.
Absolutely.
So several years ago, you launched a robotics conference here in Miami that has since gone around the globe. The focus of that conference, We Robot, is exploring the legal standards for new technologies in robotics.
In robotics and AI, yes.
Why was it important for you to start that conference in the first place?
Well, it came out of the internet experience, right? I mentioned how those graduate students had been sitting in a room and making these standards, which then turned out to have really important real-world ramifications. For example, one of the standards they created is how domain names work, and none of them had heard of trademark law. So they built a system which ended up causing enormous amounts of litigation and angst because it conflicted with trademarks, which are narrow, national, sectoral, right? You can have Delta Airlines and Delta Faucets, but you can only have one Delta.com. So we spent literally hundreds of thousands of dollars sorting out the implications of that. What if they'd just done it slightly differently? If there'd been a lawyer in the room, we wouldn't have that problem. And when robots started getting big about 10 years ago, I said, I've seen this movie before. Let's get everybody together. Let's get together in an interdisciplinary meeting. And we ended up with philosophers, lawyers, ethicists, the military, designers, all kinds of great people in the room and let's talk about what the emerging policy questions are, and hopefully we can design around at least some of them and save everybody a lot of trouble. I think that's what's paying off. It takes a long time for those kinds of efforts to pan out, but I think it's helping.
And when you say robots, how do you define robots? Like, is someone's Alexa or Google Home a robot?
Well, that's a great question. We struggled with a lot when we were putting the conference together. I have to confess that before I got involved with the engineers and philosophers, I imagined that a robot had to have a physical body, right? So it had to sense something in the world and react to it. But I was persuaded by smarter people than me, actually, that was the wrong definition, that a robot can be purely software, that an AI counts as a robot, right? You plug an AI into the internet, it collects up data, and it sends off messages or trades stock or does something. That's a robot, like one where, you know, like Robbie the robot, in Lost in Space.
So keeping on this topic of Google Home and Alexa, there, I mentioned there's a murder trial or a murder case in Hallandale Beach that, the police have asked for recordings mm-hmm. related to that. Not to go too much into the specifics of that case, but it does present some questions about who's able to access what.
Yes and no. If I put on my law professor hat for a minute, if you'll forgive me.
Oh, please, please.
The frame you started with, here's a witness, is not the frame a lawyer would use, except in talking to a jury. Because what we have here is a record, right? We have data held by a company, a third party. And we have extensive, well-traveled law about when the police can access records, right? The bank has your bank statements, and they're trying to investigate you for tax fraud. You don't get to say, but I wrote the bank a letter and said, don't tell anybody. So once that record's out of your control, and sometimes even when it's in your control, if it's on paper in your computer, the police can get it.
Because a record has been created, I suppose.
The record, it's a thing, right? And then we have a lot of law about how the police, with the right judicial process, can go and get things that might be incriminating to you.
And so on people are bringing these technologies into their home. Are they creating records that can later be accessed and used against them? Does that bring
so
up
that
some concerns for you?
That depends on three things. One is, what does it say in the contract? Right? I mean, what are they saying they're going to do with your data? And the second is, do they actually do what they promised? And the third is, can someone hack the device and get it to do something other than what the company said it was going to do?
And what are the current privacy laws when it comes to something like recording your voice and selling that to data, or that data to advertiser or to someone else?
So again, the law here is relatively clear, mm-hmm. Although it varies a little bit from state to state. If somebody surreptitiously puts a recording device in your house without a court order, that's eavesdropping and wiretapping, and that's very illegal. If someone records your phone call in Florida without your consent, we're a two-party consent state, right? So both sides of the conversation have to consent. That's very illegal. But if you sign a contract when you buy the device, right, you click, I agree to the terms and conditions, and the terms and conditions say we can record you, now consent is a complete defense. So the only question is, what exactly did you consent to? And that takes us into the weeds of the contract.
And, to keep going into the hypotheticals a little bit, if you walk into someone's home and they've agreed to have themselves recorded, you haven't necessarily agreed to have yourself recorded. Does that present its own issues, or is there
clarity
there?
Oh, totally. Now we're having fun.
Let's go there. Totally. Please indulge.
That is absolutely totally an issue. Because, you have a house guest for dinner, and they haven't agreed. If you don't tell them the thing is there, they haven't agreed to the contract, right? So people are actually bringing cases in California about those fact circumstances, because California has an unusually strong privacy law. And one of the things that's unusual about it is, in the ordinary privacy claim, in most states you have to bring it as a tort claim. And to win a tort claim, you have to show how you were harmed, to show your damages. And that can be quite tough. So you got recorded. How did it hurt you, really? And by the way, the answer isn't that it showed I murdered somebody, because then you don't have a leg to stand on. But it's just an ordinary case, right? But in California, there's a statutory damages. So you don't have to prove the amount of damages. It's presumed a $5,000 damage if you can't prove it up. So that does give you a real case in California, but that wouldn't work in Florida.
I'm speaking with University of Miami law professor Michael Frumkin. Frumkin is the founder of the We Robot Conference, which focuses on legal and policy issues in the field of robotics. We're discussing privacy issues connected to smart speakers and home devices. There's a murder case now in Hallandale Beach where police want to gain access to the alleged killer's Amazon Echo Dot. You can find more information on that at our social media at WLRN Sundial. And so, Michael, if you've been charged with a crime and law enforcement believes the information is on Alexa or Google Home and that it can be valuable, how easy is it for them to access that information?
Well, I mean, in principle, it's just a matter of convincing a judge to issue, you know, jurisdiction to issue a court order to the company to turn it over. I don't think it's any different from a bank record.
So you're saying it's relatively straightforward. They would just
ask
for access.
Because it's new, judges have been a little cautious about it. But I think this case will probably set a precedent that judges will be quite happy to follow.
And how do our privacy laws compare with what we see abroad, like what we see in Europe?
We are 10, 15 years behind the times. I mean, Europe has an extensive set of privacy laws, the latest iteration of which is called the GDPR. And they have all kinds of limitations on data collection, and especially data reuse. Now, again, that wouldn't protect you against the police, right? That, absolutely not. But it protects you against commercial reuse of your information without a lot of hoops being jumped through. And we don't have anything like that. Here, basically, the default is if you sell your information or you sign a consent to the release of information or you transact with a merchant in the absence of any confidentiality agreement, they're free to do anything they like with that information with very few limits. I mean, they can't do false things. They're, if you're famous, they can't say, you know, Tom Cruise shops here, you should too. They have special protections, you know, for endorsements. And they can't lie to you about what they're going to do. So if they make you promises, we have pretty good law that forces them to keep their promises. So they don't make promises.
Are there currently actions being taken at the federal level to do something about this and maybe catch us up to where Europe is?
So there are two strands here. One is that the FTC has done a pretty good job of monitoring companies that, you know, make a promise in their terms of service about privacy and then don't do it. And they get into trouble and they pay fines. And, you know, I think that there's been enough of that that, you know, businesses, at least, you know, sensible businesses, worry about that problem and are really incentivized to either water down their terms of service or keep their promises. The other thing is there's been a spate of new privacy bills introduced in Congress. I mean, this is a very deadlocked Congress, so it's not all clear that any of them would pass. But there clearly is interest in both the House and the Senate for some kind of privacy law, although whatever we get will be much, much less than what they have in Europe, both because the consensus isn't there and also because of the First Amendment, right? And the First Amendment means that when you know something true about someone, it's quite hard to regulate you to prevent you from sharing that true fact. And in Europe, which does certainly protect free speech, but not quite in the same way we do, it is possible in many circumstances, especially in a commercial context, to prevent that from being shared.
And Michael, do you believe governments can effectively legislate this issue, or is that something at this point with this deadlocked Congress, is it something that companies should be taking the initiative on their own part and setting their own standards, and then maybe the government will follow later?
Well, things always work out better if the companies lead, because then you don't hear them in Congress saying you're going to impose a cost on us because they've already done it. So that's easy. The thing I would say is that to the extent we're going to regulate, we're going to have to regulate at the point of collection, because that's the place where the First Amendment is weakest. So you can ban probably certain types of collection in ways you couldn't ban as easily certain types of reuse.
Which is, I suppose, part of the debate that's going on with facial recognition, right? If you ban how someone collects that on the street level, then you don't have to worry about it down the line, how it's being used.
Absolutely. I think facial recognition is a huge issue. I've written a piece a couple of years ago calling it privacy pollution, right? By putting all these cameras in place, we're polluting the privacy in public. We should treat it just like that. People, I argued, ought to have to file an environmental impact statement, a privacy impact statement, before they're allowed to do that to us.
So there's increasing concern about an individual's health data being captured and sold by companies. For instance, earlier this year, Florida's chief financial officer, Jimmy Patronis, warned Floridians about sharing medical information with their smart speakers. And it was uncovered by Bloomberg News that Amazon employees were actually collecting voice recordings and transcribing those conversations. Amazon claims that it's using that information to improve the voice recognition software. But if you're a user and you go to one of these technologies to help yourself, how can you protect yourself and know that that sensitive information is not being shared around,
Well, what I tell my
or
friend,
used for where
what
you
I
just
tell
even think?
my students and my friends, if there's one surefire way to protect yourself against these home devices, don't buy them. Don't let them in the house. That's the only sure way to protect yourself. And if you can't bring yourself to do that, get a metal trash can and put it on top of it when you're not using it. Now, the classic advice you're going to see online is a little different, right? They say, oh, get into the settings and turn off the microphone and the camera when you aren't using it. And that's good advice. Although you have to then trust the company to actually honor those settings, which is probably a fairly good bet most of the time. But you also have to trust that the devices aren't hackable and some third party can't come in and do that. And that's a slightly less good bet because, everyone's fallible and people find bugs in software and you never know what's going to happen. The advice online is, go into the settings and delete all the old recordings. And that's good advice. But again, you got to trust the company to do that. And if it's not automated, so it happens regularly, you got to schedule it to do it on the first of every month.
Got it. So there was a quickly, because we're running out of time, but there was a landmark case out of Orlando last week where a Florida detective was able to access the data of a genealogical website called GED Match. And previously, companies were able to block law enforcement from accessing that data, but in this case, it's gone beyond that. So if this is something different than smart speakers, but it also goes to privacy, this is coming up in all different parts of American contemporary life at this point. Just in general, how would someone who's a consumer protect their privacy?
Well, again, the easiest way is don't do it. Otherwise, what you have to do is sign up for the service under a false name and use a PO box that you don't use for anything else, so they can't connect it to you. Of course, that devalues to some extent. It makes it harder. If part of your goal is to have people who have some genetic similarity to you find you, that's going to make it tougher. You have to make a trade-off. But basically, this is another case of a record. Now, it's a slightly different kind of law because it's a health record, arguably. So, health privacy law, which is a little bit stronger than regular privacy law, kicks in perhaps. But even so, it is a record. And there are ways in which, the police can get records from third parties there too.
Got it.
Now, there is doctor-patient privilege, but that probably doesn't apply here.
That was University of Miami law professor Michael Frumkin. Frumkin is the founder of the We Robot Conference, which focuses on legal and policy issues in the field of technology. You can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And that's Sundial for Thursday, November 14th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandra Martinez. Our intern is Sherilyn Cabrera. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontalo is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zabka. Our technical supervisor is Peter J. Mayers. Coming up next week on Sundial, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week about the future of deferred action for childhood arrivals, or DACA. We'll meet a DACA recipient living here in Miami who traveled to Washington, D.C. to participate in the protests. Also, we meet the new mayor of Homestead, Steve Lausner. We'll discuss some of the critical issues facing his community and his top priorities in office. Finally, next week is the Miami Book Fair. There's a new collection of short stories that will be featured at the fair, showing how we do and don't get around in South Florida. One story is about getting around Miami during the Zika scare while pregnant. A reminder, NPR will continue to have special coverage of the impeachment hearings into next week. You can also always stay up to date of the impeachment hearings at WLRN.org. I'm Danny Rivero. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week.